Hello, I'm Steve LeGrand, and I'm here today with Dr. Tarvez Tucker, a neurologist and a neurointensivist, as well as an author. To start off with, Dr. Tucker, what is a neuro-ICU?
So I think we're all familiar with the intensive care unit, the ICU. This is where, in the hospital, the sickest, most critically injured patients go. The neuro-ICU, or neurology ICU, is where patients with injuries or illness of the brain, the spinal cord, the peripheral nerve, this is where they're taken care of. So what we see in our neuro-ICU are strokes, bleeding into the brain, gunshot wounds to the head, spinal cord injuries that might cause and do cause paralysis. And the ICU is where patients are very closely monitored because people with brain injuries can't often breathe on their own. They have hemodynamic or blood pressure swings, very high, dangerously low, and also rise in intracranial pressure. So they need to be closely watched.
How did you choose neurocritical care as a career path?
I'm a neurologist, but was a headache specialist for many, many years. And I loved headache medicine because, as a migraine sufferer myself, I know that migraine is one of the most disabling medical conditions that there is, and it especially afflicts young and middle-aged women disproportionately over men. I helped develop some of the earliest Botox trials for chronic migraine, which was truly a lifesaver for many of my patients, both men and women. And one summer, I took a course in traditional Chinese medicine, which helped me to learn acupuncture, which actually was a wonderful ancillary treatment for patients with a headache that didn't involve taking medications. But along the way in my career in headache medicine, I had four sons. I think this was probably because I missed the birth control class in medical school. But when my youngest, Alex, left for college, I was a little bit bored with my career and wanted to do something different. So I took on a challenge. I took a fellowship, which is extra training, in neurocritical care. So the critical illness and injury that occurs in patients with brain and spinal cord disease. And I was probably the oldest fellow in the nation, but I loved it. My attendings were, many of them, half my age. And eventually I got better because in the beginning it was tough for me as a neurologist to do invasive procedures such as intubations, placing breathing tubes, placing large caliber catheters into the neck to large vessels to support blood pressure and heart rate. So I stuck myself with the needle several times and ended up in the emergency department, but eventually I got better and I loved it and still do.
What's it like working in the neuro ICU?
So it ranges from controlled chaos when life flight arrives, so a helicopter that brings somebody with a catastrophic injury, high intracranial pressure, for example, from a ruptured aneurysm. But then we also are part of much more calm and serious conversations about the end of life and what a patient and his or her family would wish. Sometimes that's embedded in controversy, which we'll talk about, and I do later in the podcast, about moral injury that occurs when those of us caring for patients have conflict with what families want and what we would wish for the patients under our care.
And Dr. Tucker, how and why did you decide to write a book?
So during my fellowship, I started just jotting down notes about the patients that had affected me. I was impressed, respected, was actually astonished by many of my patients and just wanted to convey their stories. And then I also, as a neurologist, wanted to apply what we know about the brain at these moments of critical injury and illness. What's happening in the brain, particularly as we approach or forestall death? And now that we have ICU resuscitation capability, that is, we can actually bring patients back from cardiac arrest, we have more tools to know what's happening in the brain at these final moments and with my patient's final words.
How do you deal with brain death when the heart is still beating?
So this is one of the toughest parts of our job as nurses and doctors, and that is we're facing a living body that no longer holds a living brain. But the person in front of us, to us and to his or her family, looks very much alive. I mean, their hearts are beating. Their chest rises and falls, although it's the ventilator that's providing these breaths. Their legs and arms are warm. Skin is pink. Eyelids sometimes flutter. But these are only bodily activities. They're not evidence of brain and brainstem life. So we're facing an individual who is brain dead, but looks still very much alive. And it's a very difficult concept for my patients' families and all of us to grasp. And many of our families never do and cannot accept brain death.
What are patients like as they approach death?
So I've been actually surprised that I never or very rarely see any of my patients do what Dylan Thomas has talked about, rage against the dying of the light. Mostly patients aren't afraid. They're quiet and slip away. And interestingly, they often speak about and to someone in their life that they've loved and lost before. So people in their lives that have died before them. And they feel their presence and actually speak with them. Instead of being anxious or agitated, what I see is that often patients are slipping into semi-consciousness. We call it obtundation. It's kind of not being aware of what's happening around them. And I wonder if it's because these patients and these people are more in touch with what's going on within. But I just wanted to say that it's not all doom and gloom, that achingly funny things happen a lot. So one of my patients, whose name was Ike, has Tourette syndrome. And I think many of us are familiar with this peculiar neurologic malady in which patients have the uncontrollable urge to blurt out vocalizations, barking. They often swear. It's called coprolalia. And they have uncontrollable tics, so violent movements of their mouth, face, and neck. It actually often improves with age, but for Ike, in his mid-50s, it hadn't gotten much better, and he had a particularly violent cervical tic that fractured one of his vertebrae in the neck, so he actually snapped his neck with this terrifically violent cervical tic, and the fracture placed pressure on his spinal cord in the neck so that he was developing quadriplegia. His limbs were becoming weak and numb, and he was in danger of ending up completely paralyzed. So he was admitted to us prior to his surgery for decompression, which would save him from quadriplegia. But in the process of this admission, we had to monitor him carefully. And what we would do is every hour, we'd poke him with a pin to make sure that his sensory level in the spinal cord wasn't ascending to interfere with his ability to breathe. He also had a urinary catheter because he had bladder and bowel incontinence. So it was a tough few hours for him before his surgery. But he was always upbeat and optimistic and talkative. So we were a little bit surprised when he was very quiet just before he left the ICU. The anesthesiologists were kind of wheeling him away on the gurney, but he suddenly sat up and said, with great glee, "Tell Dr. Tucker the motherfucker, good riddance and goodbye." So I remember him well, and he did beautifully.
How do you handle uncertainty when you're dealing with patients with severe brain injuries?
So you'd think that in the ICU, where 1 in 6 Americans will actually die, that the diagnosis of death would be certain, but actually it's not. And what we have now, the capability, is watching EEGs, so encephalograms, electroencephalograms of patients just before, during, and just after cardiac arrest, so that is death. And what we found is fascinating. There is EEG activity, which is very fast in the gamma range. in two areas in the brain, the visual cortex and our memory centers. And what we believe is there's a universal theme that patients who have survived cardiac arrest, so who have survived death, actually describe. And the universal theme is common amidst cultures, countries, and across the spectrum of patients that have experienced death in our country and elsewhere around the world. They describe a supreme light, a sense of seeing a light at the end of the tunnel, sometimes being lifted by this light in an out-of-body experience. And they also describe a kind of rerun or a replay of their lives from early childhood onward. And what we're learning now is there is a correlate in the brain with this fast gamma electrical activity in the visual cortex that probably correlates with the sense that these patients give us, the descriptions they give us of seeing this bright light and feeling this supreme light and this sense of peace. And also, since the memory centers are activated, we can sense that they may be actually experiencing in a very lucid way portions of their lives and memories from childhood through adulthood to the age that they are now.
And finally, what are some of the challenges facing healthcare providers, patients, and families when dealing with critical illness?
So some of the podcasts that I talk about capture our stories, the stories we have with our patients in the ICU, but also these podcasts are a story of what happens in the ICU to healthcare providers, to nurses especially, respiratory therapists, physical, occupational therapists, and physicians. We have, in many cases, what has been described originally from Vietnam veterans as moral injury, but it occurs in the ICU as well. When our hopes, expectations for a patient in the setting of our knowledge, our scientific knowledge of what that patient's prognosis may be, actually clashes with what a family and loved ones and friends wish. Usually, it's the patient's families want us to go on no matter what. They say, Dr. Tucker, please do absolutely everything. He or she is courageous. They've fought this before. A miracle can occur. Do everything you can. But what we know as neurologists is that instead of prolonging life, in many cases, we are prolonging death, and that there's suffering that occurs as we try to keep people alive for as long as possible. But interestingly, sometimes the opposite happens, the flip side of this, and that is that an individual comes to us, a patient with, for example, a posterior fossa hemorrhage, so a base of the brain bleeding that we know, interestingly, has a good prognosis. But a family member will say to us, stop, don't go on, take out the breathing tube, take out the feeding tubes and your intravenous access, because he, this is a patient whose sister told me this just recently, he had been suicidal all his life, had been houseless, depressed, didn't want to go on, so we don't want you to go on. And this is tough for us because we know from a scientific basis that his prognosis would be good, and yet we're asked to stop and allow him to die peacefully. And sometimes at this point we involve the hospital's ethics committee because we can't really reconcile what we know might be his future with what his sister wanted for him.
Thank you, Dr. Tucker. Dr. Tucker's book, The Brain at Twilight, will be published by Columbia University Press and be available in 2027.